Hello and welcome to another episode of Exiting the Cave Short Reads. This week we finally finish Book 3 of The Consolation of Philosophy. Summarizing the conclusions that Boethius has come to thus far, Lady Philosophy presses him with yet another conundrum, and just at the very moment of his mystical bliss, Boethius is once again tossed into the storm of logical confusions and contradictions. Let's listen in as she presages the topic of the very next book, The Problem of Evil. Then I said, "With all my heart, I agree with Plato. Indeed, this is now the second time that these things have been brought back to my mind. First, I lost them through the clogging contact of the body. Then after, through the stress of heavy grief." Then she continued, "If thou wilt reflect upon thy former admissions, it will not be long before thou dost also recollect that of which erstwhile thou didst confess thyself ignorant."
"What is that?" said I.
"The principles of world's government," said she.
"Yes, I remember my confession, and although I now anticipate what thou intendest, I have a desire to hear the argument plainly set forth."
"A while ago thou deemest it beyond all doubt that God doth govern the world."
"I do not think it doubtful now, nor shall I ever, and by what reasons I am brought to this assurance I will briefly set forth. This world could never have taken shape as a single system out of parts so diverse and opposite, were it not that there is one who joins together all these so diverse things. And when it has once come together, the very diversity of natures would have dissevered it and torn it asunder in universal discord, were it not one who keeps together what he has joined. Nor would the order of nature proceed so regularly, nor could its course exhibit motions so fixed in respect of position, time, range, efficacy, and character, unless there were one who, himself abiding, disposed these various vicissitudes of change. This power, whatsoever it be, whereby they remain as they were created, and are kept in motion, I call by the name which all recognize, God." Then she said, "Seeing that such is thy belief, it will cost me little trouble, I think, to enable thee to win happiness and return in safety to thine own country. But let us give our attention to the task that we have set before ourselves. Have we not counted independence in the category of happiness and agreed that God is absolute happiness?" "Truly we have."
"Then he will need no external assistance for the ruling of the world. Otherwise, if he stands in need of aught, he will not possess complete independence."
"That is necessarily so," said I.
"Then by his power alone he disposes all things."
"It cannot be denied."
"Now, God was proved to be absolute good."
"Yes, I remember."
"Then he disposes all things by the agency of good. If it be true that he rules all things by his own power, whom we have agreed to be good, and he is, as it were, the rudder and helm by which the world's mechanism is kept steady and in order."
"Heartily, I do agree. And indeed, I anticipate what thou wouldst say, though it may be in feeblest surmise only."
"I well believe it," said she, "for, as I think, thou now bringest to the search eyes quicker in discerning truth. But what I shall say next is no less plain and easy to see."
"What is it?" said I.
"Why," said she, "since God is rightly believed to govern all things with the rudder of goodness, and since all things do likewise, as I have taught, haste toward good by the very aim of nature, can it be doubted that his governance is willingly accepted, and that all submit themselves to the sway of the disposer as conformed and tempered to his rule?"
"Necessarily so," said I. No rule would seem happy if it were a yoke imposed on reluctant wills, and not the safe keeping of obedient subjects. There is nothing, then, which, while it follows nature, endeavors to resist the good.
No, nothing.
But if anything should, will it have the least success against him who we rightly agree to be the supreme lord of happiness?
It would be utterly impotent.
There is nothing, then, which has either the will or the power to oppose this supreme good.
No, I think not.
So then, said she, it is the supreme good which rules in strength and graciously disposes all things.
Then said I, how delighted am I at thy reasonings and the conclusions to which thou hast brought them, but most of all at these words which thou usest. I am now at last ashamed of the folly that so sorely vexed me before.
Thou hast heard the story of the giants assailing heaven, but a beneficent strength disposed of them also, as they deserved. But shall we submit our arguments to the shock of mutual collision? It may be from the impact some fair spark of truth may be struck out.
If it be thy good pleasure, said I.
No one can doubt that God is all-powerful.
No one at all can question it who thinks consistently.
Now, there is nothing which one who is all-powerful cannot do.
Nothing.
But can God do evil, then?
Nay, by no means.
Then evil is nothing, said she, since he, to whom nothing is impossible, is unable to do evil.
Art thou mocking me? Said I, weaving a labyrinth of tangled arguments, now seeming to begin where thou didst end, and now to end where thou didst begin? Or dost thou build up some wondrous circle of divine simplicity? For truly, a little before thou didst begin with happiness, and say it was the supreme good, and didst declare it to be seated in the supreme Godhead. God himself, too, thou didst affirm to be supreme good and all complete happiness. And from this thou didst go on to add, as by the way, the proof that no one would be happy unless he were likewise God. Again, thou didst say that the very form of good was the essence both of God and of happiness, and didst teach that the absolute one was the absolute good, which was sought by universal nature. Thou didst maintain also that God rules the universe by the governance of goodness, that all things obey him willingly, and that evil has no existence in nature. And all this thou didst unfold without the help of assumptions from without, but by inherent and proper proofs drawing credence one from the other. Then she answered,
far is it from me to mock thee. Nay, from the blessing of God whom we lately addressed in prayer, we have achieved the most important of all objects. For such is the form of the divine essence, that neither can it pass into things external, nor take up anything external to itself, but, as Parmenides says of it, in body like to a sphere on all sides perfectly rounded. It rolls the restless orb of the universe, keeping itself motionless the while. And if I have also employed reasonings not drawn from without, but lying within the compass of our subject, there is no cause for thee to marvel, since thou hast learnt on Plato's authority that words ought to be akin to the matter of which they treat. Blessed he whose feet have stood beside the fount of good. Blessed he whose will could break earth's chains for wisdom's sake. The Thracian bard, 'tis said, mourned his dear consort dead. To hear the plaintive strain, the woods moved in his train, and the stream ceased to flow, held by so soft a woe. The deer, without dismay, beside the lion lay, the hound by song subdued, no more the hare pursued. But the pang unassuaged in his own bosom raged. The music that could calm all else brought him no balm. Chiding the powers immortal, he came to hell's portal. There breathed all tender things upon his sounding strings. Each rhapsody high wrought his goddess mother taught. All he from grief could borrow, and love redoubling sorrow, till, as the echoes waken, all Taenarus is shaken. Whilst he to Ruth persuades the monarch of the shades with dulcet prayer. Spellbound, the triple-headed hound, at sounds so strangely sweet, falls crouching at his feet. The dreaded avengers, too, that guilty minds pursue with ever-haunting fears, are all dissolved in tears. Ixion on his wheel a respite brief doth feel, for lo, the wheel stands still. And while those sad notes thrill, thirst-maddened Tantalus listens, oblivious of the stream's mockery and his long agony. The vulture, too, doth spare some little while to tear at Titius's rent side, sated and pacified. At length the shadowy king his sorrows pitying, "He hath prevailed," cried, "we give him back his bride. To him she shall belong as guerdon of his song. One sole condition yet upon the boon is set. Let him not turn his eyes to view his hard-won prize till they securely pass the gates of hell. Alas, what law can lovers move? A higher law is love. For Orpheus, woe is me, on his Eurydice, day's threshold all but won, looked, lost, and was undone. Ye who the light pursue, this story is for you, who seek to find a way unto the clearer day. If on the darkest past one backward look ye cast, your weak and wandering eyes have lost the matchless prize. The central conundrum of this chapter is addressed most vividly in the allegory of Orpheus. In addition to providing some deep cultural context around the problem of evil, this allegory is laden with layers of additional meaning in the context of the constellation. For starters, the Orphic myth was, for the classic Greeks, the closest thing they had to the Christian redemption story. Orpheus descends into the underworld to rescue his beloved. Christ, after crucifixion, descends into hell to rescue his beloved. But there are some significant differences in these two patterns. In the case of Orpheus, it is the exhibition of his inherent godlike talents that conquers death, and his prize is one woman, albeit the woman he loves. In the case of Christ, it is the surrendering of his godlike powers to his mortality that conquers death, and the prize is the redemption of all mankind. But there are other subtle parallels here as well. For example, Eurydice dies when bitten by a snake while fleeing from a lust-filled pursuer. Like the story of Adam and Eve in Genesis, then, the story of Orpheus has an association with sin and temptation that is palpable. Other allegorical parallels are more directly related to Boethius's present situation. Firstly, Orpheus's parents, Apollo and Calliope, the god of the intellect and the muse of song. We've mentioned Apollo a few times in previous episodes. He is perhaps the masculinized pagan identity of Lady Philosophy herself, but the association with music is especially interesting. For the last few chapters, we've been focused especially on divine order and the harmonious arrangement of nature. Music is the one phenomenon that seems to successfully combine the natural symmetry and self-sustaining truth of mathematics with the natural beauty of artistic expression. Here, we have a representation of that belief in mythical form. The divine symbol of reason and the divine symbol of the music of the spheres combining to produce Orpheus, who is tragically doomed to be denied his one true love.
And it is interesting that in Boethius' retelling, which itself is an amalgam of accounts from Ovid, Virgil, and Seneca, he makes a point of repudiating the idea that love conquers all, insisting that the divine order is something that no man, semi-divine or otherwise, may deny for love or any other reason. This is consonant with the argument in this week's prose as well, which insists both that God disposes all things by the agency of the good, and that anything that could even attempt to oppose his agency would be utterly impotent against it. For the ancient Greeks, this poses no obvious problem. Orpheus's tragedy is simply an archetypal depiction of the tragedy that befalls all men, and even most gods, in one form or another. Tragedy is simply written into the order of all things. But for Boethius, it is a huge problem, because as Lady Philosophy makes clear, God is omnipotent and the supreme good, and nothing would have either the will or the power to oppose the supreme good. And yet, would we not say that Eurydice's, indeed also Boethius's, untimely demise is an evil? Boethius gives us the prepackaged Neoplatonic response to this in the words of Lady Philosophy. Since there is nothing that God cannot do, and God cannot do evil, then evil is nothing. This, to me, is a really weak argument at best that relies on some semantic sleight of hand to seem plausible. For example, we could restate the whole argument by removing the double negatives, and the contradiction will immediately expose itself. Because God is omnipotent, God can do everything. Because God is omnibenevolent, everything that God does is good. Therefore, of all the things that God does, they are all good, and since God does everything, all things are therefore necessarily for the good. Okay, then who's responsible for Eurydice's death? To ask this question, though, implies that there are some things that God does not do, or at least that he is not responsible for. Yet we've already agreed that God is responsible for everything. So then, are we saying that Eurydice's demise is somehow a good thing? I think this would be a hard sell for any normal human being. Who is not caught in the throat just a little by the end of Boethius's epic verse? So the Neoplatonic answer seems to me to be insufficient to the problem. And so, this is where some of the more subtle layers of the allegory fall into place. Boethius is in search of beatific bliss as much as he is philosophical consolation. He wants to know the peace of pure wisdom before facing his own demise. Yet just as he reaches the peak moment of clarity, he looks back over his shoulder, and it's snatched away. The first line of the verse is a callback to Virgil, who opined in his Georgics,
"He who has learned the true cause of things is happy, and has set all fear and unrelenting fate, and the noise of greedy Acheron under his feet."
According to Virgil, one of Boethius's key sources, the Acheron is the source of the Styx, and the river across which Charon ferries the newly dead. Boethius is as much as admitting here that he does not think he has achieved the happiness of which Virgil speaks. At the end of the verse, in a desperate attempt to warn those coming after him, those who pursue the light, tells them to beware their weak and wandering eyes. In the context of the previous chapter, this is a not-so-subtle warning to never forget. Perhaps this is Boethius's chief regret? But to return to one prior point, is Boethius right that love is, after all, not a higher law than the divine order? This may be the most significant distinction between pagan mythology and Christian theodicy, even amongst the Neoplatonists. Boethius himself makes an implicit reference to Augustine's Confessions in this chapter when crafting his solution to the problem of evil, which he partially borrows from Augustine. But within the same book of the Confessions, Augustine also has some counsel for Boethius that he does not seem to make mention of.
namely,
by the Platonic books I was admonished to return into myself. With you as my guide, I entered into my innermost citadel, and was given power to do so because you had become my helper. I entered, and with my soul's eye, such as it was, saw above that same eye of my soul the immutable light higher than my mind. Not the light of every day, obvious to anyone, nor a larger version of the same kind which would, as it were, have given out a much brighter light and filled everything with its magnitude. It was not that light, but a different thing, utterly different from all our kinds of light. It transcended my mind, not in the way that oil floats on water, nor as heaven is above the earth. It was superior because it made me, and I was inferior because I was made by it. The person who knows the truth knows it, and he who knows it knows eternity. Love knows it. Eternal truth and eternal love and beloved eternity, you are my God.
What Augustine is insisting here is that truth and goodness are, as Lady Philosophy has been arguing up to now about goodness and happiness, a unity identified with love, and that love is synonymous with God. So, to say that love is subordinate to divine order is incoherent, since they are, in effect, the same thing. Truth, goodness, and beauty are alternative names for this divine love, something we've already addressed in an earlier chapter of the Consolation. It's not clear to me why Boethius seems to have forgotten Lady Philosophy's paean to divine love at the end of Book 2. It seems to me it would have been the perfect capstone to stitch up the case for unity by coupling it to that, through Augustine's counsel here. Perhaps he was so focused on the rationalist case at this point that it had just slipped his mind. Or perhaps he lacked the confidence to take the last step in the journey to truth, at least as the Neoplatonics saw it. Which gets me to my next observation in this chapter. There is one more meaning to extract from the allegory of Orpheus. To reach the pure light of truth and to be taken up fully by the love of God, you have to let go of your attachment to terrestrial forms of knowledge. At the risk of putting too fine a point on it, you must forego reason and evidence and embrace faith in the world beyond. What Orpheus did by looking back at the last moment was to betray his fundamental lack of faith. He did not trust that his beloved would follow him all the way to the light of day, and that insecurity overcame him at the most crucial moment, to tragic effect. Augustine is credited with a quite famous statement about human reason and the nature of God. Si comprehendis, non est Deus. If you understand, that isn't God. What Augustine is suggesting here is that definitional coherence, rational argument, and even contemplation will only get you as far as standing at the threshold of belief, let alone understanding. The point Augustine is driving at is that while we are reliant upon the finite and incomplete tools of human reason, a whole understanding of God will necessarily remain out of reach. To go beyond the threshold requires a willed act of surrender, in a sense, to belief, leaving reason and empiricism behind at the cave entrance, having exhausted their purpose. So once again as well, we see the allegory of the cave popping up here. Orpheus ascending from the underworld with his bride close behind is making the journey of the unchained prisoner. But unlike Socrates' freed cave dweller, who is eventually obliged to return to the cave to rescue his fellow prisoners, Orpheus is cursed by his impulse to turn back. In this chapter of the Consolation, then, we also have competing visions of personal redemption. In Orpheus, it is the individual's complete surrender of the self to reunion with God. In Socrates, it is the bringing of others to that reunion. Perhaps this was another aspiration of Boethius in writing this work. Or perhaps this work is an expression of regret at not having had the chance to do that. It's hard to say for sure. But again, the redemption lurking in the background of this debate is one that Boethius seems to have forgotten. As a Roman Christian, and one well-versed in Augustinian theology, Boethius just as easily could have leaned on the story of Christ and his role as a Christian in that story for his ultimate redemption. In that story, he gets not just the reconciliation of the one and the many, but also resolution of sinful nature and the cleansing of the corrupt world through the sacrifice of Christ. Whether we as readers accept the theodicy or not is beside the point. The point is Boethius accepted it. So why did he lean so heavily instead on Greek mythology for his consolation, rather than on the religion in which he was indeed also a learned scholar? Could it be that this chapter is also in some sense a signal that Boethius' own faith in God was shaken by the events which had overtaken him? I suppose this is possible. But alas, I cannot say for sure, and I've found nothing in the literature on the consolation to indicate one way or the other. Nobody seems to have asked the question. In any case, next week we'll take a momentary break from the text to explore the identity of Lady Philosophy herself, and to examine the parallels between her and the figure of wisdom personified in the Book of Wisdom. And we'll also look at her relationship to Solomon in that book, and how it parallels the relationship between Boethius and Lady Philosophy. I hope you enjoy it.